This is episode 7 of the Nothing Human podcast, Three Powers of the Human Spirit, Part 7, On the Intellect.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast. A biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. Welcome back to the Nothing Human podcast. We're going to talk about the intellect today. But before, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the things. Number one, I'm really thankful for all of the encouragement and engagement that you guys have been throwing my way concerning the podcast. It has been really encouraging, and I very much appreciate it. I want to give a special shout out to Lisa Hood, who was the first member to join my Patreon group and is supporting me now monthly so that I can do this and write articles once a month. And I really appreciate it. Thank you, Lisa, so much, not just for your financial support, but also for the way that you've engaged with the podcast. Your questions on my website have been extremely interesting, and it's been extremely helpful for me to have your questions and your engagement as a sounding board to determine whether or not I'm doing something that's useful to you all. So if you have questions, please send them to me on my website on the appropriate episode in the comment section there. I answer pretty much all the comments on my website. And also, if you would, I would really appreciate if you rated and reviewed my podcast on Apple Podcast or on Spotify in order to get me bumped up in the algorithm so that other people who might like this can also have the opportunity to see it in their feeds. I really appreciate it. Thank you all very much. We actually crossed over the 1,000 play mark on Apple Podcast, which was a little milestone and not actually a huge amount, but pretty awesome and encouraging to me, especially because I've done and have been able to do no advertising for this podcast. So that's all you guys. I really appreciate it. Thank you all so much. I'm going to begin this episode on the intellect by talking about an experiment that's particularly fascinating to me. And the way they set up the experiment was this. They brought in a group of mostly women, and they told them that the purpose of the study was to determine if interviewers for jobs and other things like that discriminated on the basis of facial scars. That if a person had facial scars, would there be more discrimination or more negative spirit or attitude from the interviewer or from the conversation partner? And the twist of the experiment was that right before these mostly women, but also a couple of men, I think, went in to have the interview or the conversation, the makeup artist would come to say that they were checking on the scar, but in fact, they were removing the scar. So the person who had these cosmetic scars applied to their face had already seen themselves in the mirror and seen that they looked cosmetically disfigured in some way with some scar really prominently on their faces. And they were about to go into these conversations. And then right before they went in, without their knowledge, these scars were removed from their faces. And what was interesting is that all of these participants pretty much said when they came back from the conversation or the interview that they had experienced heightened and unusual amounts of aggression and discrimination and negative attitudes during these interviews and conversations. Now, we know, because the scars were taken off of their faces, that it wasn't because they actually had scars. And so the study attempted to distinguish between whether or not they had these feelings of discrimination because of a self-fulfilling prophecy or because of confirmation bias. What that means is, if it were self-fulfilled prophecy, what that would mean is that a person went in expecting to be discriminated against and was therefore cagey or withholding or rude in a way that actually elicited rude responses from the interviewer or conversation partner. In fact, that wasn't so much the case. It was more that the people going in with, you know, thinking they had scars on their faces were just reading into and assuming things because they expected to see that there was going to be an additional amount of discrimination. And so because they expected that, they found it. They saw it wherever it was. And so the experimenters determined this was confirmation bias. Why this is interesting, or why this is apropos in the realm of the intellect, is because if the intellect is designed to determine how things are, and if you're thinking that the intellect is just some unbiased, neutral observer who just takes in information, you are incorrect. That is just not the way it works. That part of the fundamental problem with the intellect is that it is by nature and by necessity biased. That's a pretty good segue into our section on misconceptions concerning the intellect. And our first misconception is that truth equals fact. The idea being there that everything out there, the facts, the neutral, observable, objective facts, if you take them all in the aggregate, meaning all together, then that equals truth. So truth equals fact, fact equals truth. And this is a pretty common misconception among Western thinkers. And it is incoherent. It is not able to be true. For one, I mean, even from what we just talked about, your understanding of the facts is already biased. So if you're going to get at the truth, not only do you have to deal with the fact that you have a limited access to all the facts, but also even the facts that you think you have, you're bringing them in, filtering them through prejudices and biases that you already have, so that you are going to see more of what you expect to see. We also understand that truth is bigger than fact, in the same way that righteousness and life are beyond the visible world. Remember in the past episodes, we talked about how the rule of righteousness, your law, has to be beyond the body. It has to encompass more than just your own individual body. In the same way, your understanding of good and evil, or of life versus death, has to encompass more than just your body. Because we said, you know, if God is righteous and God is life, then obviously that has to mean something beyond just material terms. Well, the same is the case in the aspect of the intellect with the truth, that in the same way that a law or taste confined entirely to one's own experience and body would be limited and disordered, so a truth confined to the sensory reality will be incomplete and ultimately disordered, if not totally wrong based on biases and other things like that. So an entirely fact-based system of truth isn't even possible, and so truth has to be personal and relational. Another way of thinking this is, how would you have access to any truth? If truth is equal to fact, how would you have access to any truth if you didn't have access to all the facts? We all know that we don't have access to all the facts. And so how is it that we can say that anything is true with any degree of certainty? Some people would say you can't say it's true with any degree of certainty, but the very idea that there is a knowledge that's at all reliable has to be based on this idea that truth is beyond fact. Truly, the greatest intellectuals in human history, even if they weren't believers or Christians or whatever, tended to believe this, that truth had to be something that was beyond just mere perception or sensory perception. I'm talking about Plato. I'm talking about Aristotle. I'm talking about, obviously, all the Christian Platonists and philosophers that came in between them. But even such, you might call them theists, like Albert Einstein, who you may have heard of, and Kurt Gödel, who was a brilliant logician, both of them had as a fundamental understanding that the only way that you could have access to truth, even in finite terms, is if there was some sense of truth beyond all finite terms. You may not be able to drink the ocean, but you certainly could swim in it. So you might not be able to have the truth in you, but you could be in the truth. And this is fundamental, especially when you're thinking about intellect having its central function in faith or belief. Faith has to do with believing into Jesus, believing into God. And that is actually the term that is used in the scriptures. Almost every time you see believe in Jesus in the New Testament, for instance, the preposition that is used in the Greek is not epsilon nu, which is pronounced n, believe n Jesus. It's actually epsilon iota sigma, which is ace. And so you're looking at this preposition that's ace, which means into, or, you know, in the idea of going into a room. The preposition en can sometimes mean by or with, and it has the idea of like on, right? And sometimes when we think about it this way, I'm believing on Jesus, I'm believing upon Jesus, but that's not really what the preposition means. It means we're believing into Jesus. So in any sense that we're using faith as the central function of the intellect in order to understand things, we're actually believing into something. I've written a pretty extensive book already about this that's in the editing stage, and it deals with truth and fact and the ideas of lying, and I'm trying to get to a more biblical understanding of what truth means. And it's not exactly the Western conception. I don't reject fact. In fact, this idea of truth being beyond fact is necessary to confirm even one fact. In the same way that I don't reject the bodily sensations that are necessary for an understanding of life here on earth, or that are necessary for the execution of the law or the governance of the body, I'm not rejecting those things at all. In fact, I'm trying to elevate them to their proper place by saying that they are moving toward a truth that is in God, a life that is in God, a righteousness that is in God. So it's the same thing here too. You should not limit your understanding of the truth to the facts. That is about the same as limiting your understanding of righteousness or affections to the body, to the sensory perceptions or material reality. And let's get into a second misconception. This one is a little bit more oriented toward three powers, and it may be a little bit more personal, because in discussing this with a lot of people, almost always nobody, especially in Western society, wants to say that they are intellect second or last. They want to say, I'm intellect first, or they might say, oh, he must be intellect first, or she must be intellect first, because they're so smart. And since I'm really smart, or they're really smart, obviously they're rational and they lead with their intellect. That is not the case. It just simply isn't the case. And it's a misconception or a misunderstanding of what I mean when I'm talking about primary partner or subject powers. So you could actually be extremely powerful in a particular faculty or power, and it still relatively be subordinate or submitted to one of your other powers, one of your partner or primary powers. And this is the case internally, right? We're talking about relative differences. And usually your most developed or cultivated power is the primary power, but not always. That's not always the case. Sometimes circumstances cause you to cultivate or raise up a particular power, or to dismiss or to abuse a particular power because of the needs of the moment or your circumstance or your community. So that can happen. But we're just talking about relative. When there's a conflict, which one is the deciding vote in a conflict between the powers? And so you could be really, really, really smart, like really, really smart, and still have your intellect as a partner power and potentially even a subject power, depending on the circumstances. So when I say you're not led by the intellect, or you think maybe I'm not led by the intellect, don't take that to mean that you're not smart. You're probably smart enough, and you might even be above average, and that's fine. But I'll tell you this just right from the get-go. I believe that there is a natural distribution of primary powers. I think that the most common primary power is external standard will. I think that is the most common in all of humanity. I think that the second most common is external standard affections. Less common than that is external standard intellect. The internal standards in all of those demographics are much, much more rare, but internal standard intellects are exceedingly rare. The likelihood that you are one, probably not. And even external standard intellect, probably not. We just don't need as many intellects as we need people who do things and who order things according to good. If you think about it, it's like, you know, practicality, efficiency, effectiveness, these things are generally done through the will and through the affections. And I'm saying even in a properly ordered society, you need few people to be leaders. You need a lot of people who are willing to execute plans and follow through on them. And there's a genius in executing plans and following through on them. I'm not at all devaluing external standard will people simply because they're more common. Because in their particular circumstances, the reason they're more common is not because they're less valuable, but because they're more valuable. We need more of them. And we just don't need that many people who are going around being like, I think this system is broken. If all you had were those, I mean, think about if you just have a room full of not even academics, but philosophers. How much do you think is getting done in that room, aside from argumentation and probably a lot of blustering? Probably nothing. So God's kind of sprinkled them into society for very good reason. They tend to be disruptors. They tend to be annoying. I mean, even Socrates himself considered himself a gadfly of society, a really annoying pest that just won't go away. That is typically what the philosophers and the prophets are. God didn't send that many prophets, and there's a reason for that. All that to say, if you're thinking, maybe I'm led by the intellect, if you are, there are ways of determining this. I'll give you an example of a situation where this can get confusing. I was recently talking to a friend of mine, and I had been present when he got into an argument with his wife. His wife had just recently received a text that one of her cousins had become a Christian recently. And the wife is telling the story of how she found out about the conversion and how it occurred. And in the midst of that, her husband wanted to know whether or not the wife had sent her cousin some good introductory information on Christianity. And so he had some particular podcasts in mind that would be helpful to her in terms of getting biblical literacy kind of jump-started. Well, the wife's purpose in telling the story was more about the conversion, and she couldn't remember all the details of which podcasts or which resources she had sent. And my friend also was interrupting her story in order to ask for further clarification about this information. She started to get a little bit flustered, and it seemed like she was responding almost as if she was being attacked. And afterwards, my friend texted me and he said, did you see that disagreement that I had with my wife? And I said, you know, yeah, I did. And he was wondering what I thought about it because he was under the impression that all he was doing was seeking information, seeking the truth. He had an intellectual aim. I had to explain to him that even though he thought and would probably defend his questioning as seeking information, that's not actually what was happening. What was actually happening is that he was, at that moment, concerned that the cousin receive good and helpful podcasts. And so he wanted to know which ones they were so that he could recommend ones that both he and his wife agreed would be best. When you're talking about what would be good or what would be right in that circumstance, that's not just seeking information. He actually did have an agenda in asking the question, a will-oriented or affections-oriented agenda. And so in that particular case, he was under the impression that he was merely seeking information, meaning that's a purely intellectual aim, just to get at the truth. And even with my friend, who was pretty well aware of the three powers, he wasn't really considering the fact that it was actually more an operation of his will and his affections in the line of questioning, and also that her will and her affections were actually being disturbed by this in the sense that he was interrupting her story, which was a little bit rude and probably made her feel a little unheard and unconsidered. But also, she had the potential of not knowing his agenda and thinking he had an agenda, which he did, and thinking maybe that agenda was in critiquing or criticizing her for not making the right choice of podcast to give to this new believer and maybe being stupid about it or maybe affecting this new believer in a way that, you know, would permanently hurt her trajectory of faith, you know, or whatever. The mind can go wild filling in the gaps. And just to complete the story, he did talk to her about all of this later and apologized, and they resolved things, so that was a real win for the three powers. The main point in me telling the story is just to illustrate how a person can be under the impression that they have a purely intellectual aim when they don't. Most people are not intellect-led, meaning their main goal isn't the truth. Their main goal isn't just getting information and growing in the truth. They have other agendas in place, and that's not wrong. It's just important to be upfront about it, to be self-aware about it, and communicate directly about it so that people aren't left in the dark about what your intentions or your agenda actually are. So, you may be really smart, and that is great, but it's very unlikely that your main goal is actually the acquisition of information or of knowledge or of truth. In fact, it's more than likely the case that if you are acquiring information, knowledge, or truth, it is for some aim, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just important to understand that's what's going on. And speaking about the intellect, we want to talk about some biblical categories that relate to the intellect that I'm sure that you've probably seen in the scriptures, especially in the wisdom literature, particularly in Proverbs. And these three words that you'll see repeated quite a bit are knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And all three of them are intellectual processes of some kind or another, or have to do with the intellect. So I want to get into this and talk a little bit about what each of these mean. Starting with knowledge, we've already explained that truth is larger than fact. So I'll just say right now that knowledge in the scriptures, generally speaking, does not have to do with neutral, objective, observable phenomena. It does have that quality, but generally speaking, the idea of knowledge is gained not through objective, neutral observation in the scriptures, but rather through intimacy. You see this all throughout the scriptures. You'll see phrases like Adam knew his wife and she conceived. I can guarantee that she did not conceive because of neutral, objective observation. That was an intimate knowing, and it produced a child. So most of the knowing in the scriptures implies a certain kind of intimacy that you couldn't really know unless you were intimate with something. And the Western idea of objective, neutral observation producing knowledge, and even the word science from scientia, the Latin, literally means knowledge. So we have very much confused within Western society this idea that knowledge comes through neutral observation. Neutral observation, as we already discussed, isn't possible. So knowledge is better suited through a process of intimacy rather than through a process of objectivity, since objectivity is not actually available to you. Knowledge, it is information, but it is information that has not yet fully been connected together or related together. It is almost pieces or data points of information. And generally speaking, you learn knowledge through imitation. So the first building blocks of information that you're given before you've even built a coherent understanding of the world, whether it's in language or whether it is in physical sensations or experiences or in skills or other things like this, these are almost all through imitation. You hear your parents speaking, you ape their speech long before you understand what the speech means. And so this will bring us to the second wisdom category or wisdom literature category of the intellect, and that is understanding. Understanding is when you start to relate different knowledges together into a coherent, larger structure of knowledge or information. I mean, if you think about knowledge as being little points, understanding is when you start drawing the lines between those points or start seeing the shape of those points. And sometimes understanding can be false. You could have a false understanding. You could cohere or synthesize the data points in a way that comes up with a shape that isn't actually accurate because there's not enough data points there. And once you get more data points, they kind of fall outside the lines and you realize, ooh, my shape is not correct. I need to reevaluate my understanding. So we talked about how knowledge is learning through imitation. Understanding would be learning through integration. So with understanding, you're integrating together the knowledge that you have acquired through imitation. Wisdom, on the other hand, is almost an integration of integration. Not only are you understanding the shapes, you're also understanding how that shape might occur in other sets of data, even in other sets of data that are new to you or in novel circumstances. I like to say that wisdom is insights of understanding in invisible circumstances, things that are not seen, learning through innovation. This is learning through innovation, meaning this actually will produce new knowledge, new data points that before were not accessible. So you have knowledge, you have understanding of wisdom, which if you're going through the process of learning, you're usually going to start with knowledge, progress to understanding, and then go from there to wisdom, meaning you're going to start with imitation, progress to integration, and then progress beyond that, potentially, to innovation. Most people, the furthest they ever get is understanding, and that's the furthest they ever need to get. Understanding is great. We know very clearly from the scriptures that if you lack wisdom, you get it from God. Wisdom is acquired as a gift. So if you have wisdom, if you have this ability to innovate, that you don't just ape language and you don't just understand what language means, you can actually create new sentences that have new meaning that people haven't thought of before. that innovation that you've been granted is a gift from God. So you're certainly not more important than other people. As we said, if you had a room full of philosophers, nothing would ever get done. So not everybody reaches the heights of wisdom, and that is okay, as long as they're willing to listen to wisdom when it comes to them from other people, from other places. If the central function of the intellect is faith or belief, I'm not talking about faith in the general terms, in the three power terms that the scriptures obviously talks about it. We will have an episode where I talk about faith and the three powers. I'm talking about the aspect of faith that specifically relates to the intellect. If you know anything about the Reformation very much zeroed in on this particular aspect of faith. The Reformers assessed, I think correctly, that the Roman Catholic Church had devalued the intellectual aspects of faith and instead was emphasizing only the volitional aspects of faith. And when you look in the Roman Catholic tradition of implicit faith, that you could believe in things that you don't understand, that is possible. It is possible to believe in things that you do not understand. I'm not totally rejecting it, but when that is used oppressively by authoritarians in order to keep people in the dark, there's a real problem. It is obvious, and the Roman Catholic Church itself has recognized this since the Reformation, that that period of time, there was a significant amount of imposed darkness because of the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. I'm sorry, if you are Catholic, I'm not against you. If you're Protestant, I'm not against you. I hope you all understand. I'm not against any of you. If you're in seeking after God in good faith, I am on your team, and I hope you recognize that. But there are obviously issues here, and the Reformation corrected and emphasized what had been lacking in emphasis in the intellectual concept of faith. So if you're a Reformed believer or a Protestant, you probably already understand that faith is intellectual, and you might actually need a little bit of help in understanding how faith also relates to the will and the affections, but we'll talk about that later. For now, let's talk about the intellectual aspects of faith. And this is most clearly explained in Hebrews 11:1, so I'll just quote this for you. The author of Hebrews writes, "Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." This relates to two different kinds of invisible. So faith is about seeing the invisible. If you're talking about faith in intellectual terms, you could actually call it the prophetic imagination. It is an imagination that sees that which is invisible. But it's important to understand, just because it's invisible doesn't mean it isn't there. It just means that you can't sense it. Again, if you're saying truth is beyond fact, well, then faith is necessary to get at the truth because it's beyond your sensory perception. And you can see that even in Hebrews 11:1 when it talks about these two kinds of invisible. It's the last one, conviction of things not seen. Well, what kind of things are real that aren't seen? Well, God, for instance, but also truth, for instance, and the connection and relationships between things and logic and other things like that. And you see this pretty clearly when God says human beings look at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart, referring to his assessment of David. The seeing of the intellect through faith is seeing things that are there, but that are not as they seem. They're not as they appear. There's something beyond the way that they appear that's actually true, and in some sense governs the way that they are, but is in some sense beyond it. So that's one kind of seeing, the invisible. Faith is a seeing of that which is there, but is not able to be sensed because it's not sensory. But faith also, you see, has the second aspect, that it's the assurance of things hoped for. Now, a hoped for thing, or a believed upon thing, is really that which isn't there because it isn't yet there. It's not that it isn't ever going to be sensory, it's just that it's not yet sensory. So, for instance, what happens to me tomorrow is not visible to me right now. In fact, what happened to me yesterday isn't visible to me right now. What happens in the future and what happened in the past, as Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, both are exceedingly remote. We can't really search them out. It's hard to discover them. And that is because they are unseen. So to have sight concerning those things that are unseen because of their lack of presentness in time is another aspect of faith. And faith trusts in God's promises and warnings about the future and God's assessment concerning history and the past, the meaning of history and the past, both of which things actually are not able to be seen or sensed anymore. So you can see, if you're talking about things that are present, that are invisible, which is a lot. A lot of the truth is invisible because a lot of what we believe to be the case, we believe because we expect it to be the case, meaning we believe it first, and then it affects everything that comes in, everything that we assess after. You can see then, if faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen, then faith is central to the functioning of the intellect. Because the intellect, if it's going to try to get at truth, and truth is beyond sensory perception, it's trying to see what is true right now that isn't sensory, and it's also trying to see things that could be sensory tomorrow but aren't yet sensory, or that were sensory yesterday but aren't still sensory, things that are no longer happening or no longer have any evidences concerning them, or the evidences are scant, or the evidences are tiny little data points that could be reshaped into any number of different shapes, and who knows what's the right shape, right? And a lot of the study of ancient history is just like that, right? You have a shred of manuscript here, you got a scrap of pottery over here, you got a femur over here, and a scrap of textile over here. And now we're going to recreate a whole civilization on the basis of those things. And you can imagine when you have that few data points and such a large shape to make, a lot of that shape you kind of speculate on. So being able to understand and have faith to be able to see those things that aren't seen, it's actually really necessary. And everybody has a kind of faith concerning those things. Some people's faith concerning them is not very good, but everybody who has any opinion on anything is basing it to some extent or another on things they take for granted. First principles that they take for granted that they've built upon. Knowledge, in other words, that they've built upon. So if we're going to talk about the intellectual aspect of faith, and we've already said you could call it the prophetic imagination, I'll give you two sentences of what the prophetic imagination actually is. The prophetic imagination is seeing things for how they really are in spite of how they seem, and seeing things for how they could be in spite of how they are. Those are the two invisible sights of faith that you see in Hebrews 11:1, just put in my own words. I think those are helpful things to consider, so take some time and think about those. We haven't even gotten to any disorders of the intellect, so let's go ahead and do that. I should have probably done this with the disorders of the other powers, but I didn't. So I'll just explain it here, and you can probably work it out yourself in terms of the other powers. There's two kinds of different disorders. One of the disorders of the powers has to do with a disorder between powers, meaning it's a disorder of a particular power because of the disordered way it's reacting to or relating to another power. But then there are also internal disorders that are disordered within a particular power because of the goal standard function. So I focused on the goal standard function, but I didn't really explain to you that some of the other disorders that I also talked about in some of those other episodes weren't really disorders within the power, but they were disorders that occurred between the powers. Any disorder in a particular power that happens between powers, it could happen because that particular power is either being dismissed and abused, or because that particular power is being transgressive outside of the jurisdiction of its particular domain. Let's talk first about the disorders of the intellect between powers. So if you have the intellect dismissed, the intellect could be dismissed by affections or by will, and it results in pretty similar realities. And this would be confirmation bias or self-fulfilling prophecy, which we talked about with the cosmetic scar experiment. But you see this oftentimes with people who want something so badly, desire something so badly. We talked about that as the overlap of the affections and will, desire. So if they want something or desire something so badly, or they think some particular thing is right, then they will dismiss or reject intellectual information that contradicts it. And the intellect, by necessity, must be free. You can see this also with the affections. The affections must be free. Because the will is a governing power, it tends to be both self-governing and others governing. But this is unhelpful, especially when you're talking about the necessary freedom for the affections or for the intellect. The intellect should be free. It doesn't matter where something comes from. It doesn't matter where something leads. If something is what something is, it should be accepted by the intellect. Now, we have problems, obviously, because we are finite. So some of the things we think are true may not be. But the intellect should remain open, then. If something in the will seems to say, this may be true, but it doesn't seem right, we're not allowed to believe this. Maybe just leave that particular thing open and allow the intellect to gain more information, or in fact, tell the intellect, hey, we're going to give you the freedom to get that additional information and do a little more study on this. That is necessary. Now, is that dangerous? Sure. I mean, when you're looking at deconstruction, that's what happens, is that the will has been grasping the intellect so tightly and disallowing it from making any kind of inquiries into anything. And then all of a sudden they realize, hey, maybe I should have a little more freedom to search out some of these things. And sometimes in their newfound freedom, they come to some really premature and terrible conclusions that oftentimes can shipwreck their faith. But you know what? They need to have the freedom to make those inquiries, and we should not be afraid of them. And ultimately, the truth is true. And there is no wisdom or counsel or understanding that's against Yahweh. And we should accept that. And we should allow the truth to do its work and persuade over time without trying to control or coerce people. And I think that that will actually do a whole lot more to furthering faith than it will to furthering unbelief. I know that might be counterintuitive, but I promise you it's the truth. So the intellect could be dismissed or abused. But a thing that happens also is that the intellect abuses the affections, and this, generally speaking, leads to sociopathy. I have experienced this, so remember I told you about my article, How Christian Rationalism Turned Me Into a Psychopath. So if you're interested in seeing how the intellect abusing the affections can create sociopathy, then I recommend you read that article, because that's exactly what it did in me. And also, the intellect, my intellect, has abused the will. So I have also experienced throughout my life the intellect abusing the will, which generally produces sloth and despair. That the intellect basically says, what's the point? And gives up. Because, as you know from Ecclesiastes, with increasing knowledge comes increasing pain. Generally speaking, the more wisdom you have, I mean, think about Ecclesiastes is considered by some to be one of the most depressing books of the Bible. Because once you truly see the value of your life on its own terms, and the value of existence even on its own terms, it's a pretty dismal picture. And unless there is something beyond that you hope in and that you love, living life can be sometimes really difficult, and it oftentimes will lead to despair and sloth. And you could say that despair also has an affectional quality, in that it is a sort of sadness. But I'm mostly talking here about the despair that paralyzes you from being able to act, basically saying, what's the point? I'm not even going to try. I'm not even going to try and make a choice, you know, and you just kind of Bartleby your way out of your life. Bartleby is a great little novella where the protagonist is a dude who just starts saying, I would prefer not to. And eventually by the end, he would prefer not to do his work. He would prefer not to leave his office. He would prefer not to take showers or take baths or eat food. And eventually he would prefer not to live. Spoiler alert. But anyway, so when I say that Bartleby, that's what I'm talking about. And that is, in some sense, the intellect totally abusing the will. So the internal disorders of the intellect would be in the goal or the standard or the function. The goal of the intellect is the truth of God. And so a disorder in that way would really be a premature resolution, like we talked about before, with lesser truth or truths, or a failure of freedom or open-mindedness. This happens a lot. So the truth of God is something that we're always going to be seeking. And just like the ocean, we're never going to be able to drink it. We're only going to be able to swim in it and see a little bit more of it. And that is really the purpose of the intellectual pursuit of the truth. So anytime you're thinking, I really got it, I'm already there, you're not. In fact, that is the opposite of the true good faith operation of the goal of the intellect. In the standard of the intellect, the standard of the intellect is kind of weird, because you could think that the goal of the intellect is truth, but also the standard of the intellect is truth. But really, when we're talking about truth, as far as the standard, we're talking about reality, and not just visible reality, but invisible reality as well, all things. And most importantly, the reality of God and the reality as God sees it. So in other words, when you're talking about the truth as a goal, you're talking about God as truth. God is the truth. The Word is the truth. Jesus is the Word of God. So we are seeking after Him as our goal. But when you're talking about truth as a standard, you're really saying what God says about reality or what God says about the world, and that is also considered truth in a still relational but less personal way. If you have a disorder of the intellect concerning the standard, then you have believed a lie. You have believed something to be real that isn't. You have trusted in a falsehood that will not deliver. And so you are involved in what we would call deception, sometimes even self-deception, where you are under the impression something is real that isn't, or that something is in accordance with reality that isn't. There's a lot of things that this applies to, and you might say, well, if my understanding of reality is actually incorrect, I'm trusting in a sense of reality that isn't even real. If I'm self-deceived, how do I break out of that? It's a really challenging problem. It basically amounts to an autoimmune disease of the intellect. When you are self-deceived, you won't even know. I mean, that's the whole point. You are deceived. You have deceived yourself. You're not just blind. You don't even know that you're blind. You're blind to your blindness. The only thing I can tell you, and you'll notice I'll bring this up quite a bit in all the powers, you got to be humble. That the biggest problem and the biggest thing that keeps people in states of self-deception is their pride. And the most important thing in using your standard and being corrected and being disciplined, because that's what is necessary, you don't have the right shape for all the data points even that you have. So you're constantly coming up with new things and being corrected, and that requires humility. I like to tell my children, you have two choices here. You can either look like a fool or you can be a fool. But you don't have any other choices than that. You have those two choices, look like a fool or be a fool. Now, in order to not be a fool, you're going to have to look like a fool because you're going to have to ask the stupid questions. You're going to have to be the person, the only person in the class who raises their hand and says, I don't know. And that requires humility. And that's, I think, one of the greatest tools to undo self-deception is to understand, if you're self-deceived, you're a person who cares a whole lot more about looking like you are wise than actually being wise. And you need to pursue humility, humble yourself before God and other people, and maybe even start in the process of imitation, gaining new knowledge and growing in your understanding of reality. The third thing, the function, a disorder of the intellect and the function. We already talked about function as prophetic imagination. So in many ways, this is a failure of prophetic imagination or a failure of faith. In other words, that in this case, you are either rejecting the warnings or the promises of God or misunderstanding the warnings and promises of God concerning the unseen future, or you are misunderstanding some unseen aspect of God's reality or of the truth itself. That is a lot harder to process through. Again, humility very much helps in this process. But in the realm of the imagination, you can see that the intellect and the affections clearly overlap. I mean, even when you're saying image, imagination, that the affections are so very helpful in supporting and helping the intellect to image things, to understand things through empathy and sympathy, putting my feet in another person's shoes. All of these are very, very, very necessary for understanding. So the affections really do support the intellect very well in terms of imagination. We even use it in those terms. We'll talk about imagination as artistic imagination, aesthetic imagination. Clearly, that's much more in the affectional realm most of the time. But there actually can be a intellectual imagination. There is an intellectual or prophetic imagination as well. And those work together really, really well, which is why a lot of your greatest visionary thinkers are also artists. That happens very regularly. One of my favorites is Dostoevsky. He was clearly as much aesthetic as he was intellectual, as much affectional as he was intellectual. But there's also a interaction between the will and the intellect and these things in terms of experience. That it is through the will that we actually gain experience and learn from experience. So, for instance, if you have a failure of the function of faith, so that you have disbelieved a promise or a warning of God, well, experience, which is achieved through the will, meaning some choice that you have made, experience is that interaction of the intellect with the will that says, hey, let's look at what we've done and let's assess how well it turned out. right? The intellect is necessary for that. This is a support of the intellect to the will and of the will to the intellect. And so, for instance, if you didn't believe a promise that God had made, or you didn't believe a warning that God had made, and he gives you another chance, which he probably will, where you say, you know what, I didn't listen to my parents. I didn't listen to God's warning on this. And look how it turned out. I didn't know it would turn out that way. But now my will is assessing, hey, this wasn't a good outcome. And my intellect is going, yep, that wasn't a good outcome. Maybe we should have trusted, and trust there is that interaction between the intellect and will. Maybe we should have trusted God. And in the future, we should. And all of a sudden, your function of faith is increased. In the same way, that can happen with the experience of God himself, that you could say, I didn't see or I did not understand these things about the truth. Sometimes experience will make it clear. Sometimes experience will make it plain. And that can only happen through the operation of the will. It's one of the reasons why the Torah, which is the word that's mostly translated law in the Old Testament, the Torah also can be translated instruction. And you might think, well, how is a law, which clearly relates to the will, supposed to be an instruction? It's because through the experience of the attempt at obedience, you're supposed to be learning to understand what God believes to be good, what God believes to be right, what God believes to be true. So the law is actually a useful teaching and instructional tool. And you can see that that's very much this overlap, that there's an overlap there between the operations of the will and the operations of the intellect. So you'll see this oftentimes with most of the powers when there's a failure function, which is like the central power of the power. Oftentimes there's a necessity for service from the other powers. So you have a failure of love. There's this necessity for a righteous law to come in and say, hey, that wasn't right, what you did. You may think it's good, but it wasn't right. Or for the intellect to come in and say, you're being false to who you really are. This is not, or here's who you really are, even if you think you're this. This is who you really are. And so oftentimes there's a failure of love. The truth and the law kind of have to come in and serve, say, hey, let's interrogate this, right? So we'll talk about that a little bit more, because I'm going to have an episode in the future where I talk about the overlaps of the powers. There's obviously huge amounts of overlaps between these. And I've said this before, and I'll probably say it again, but the powers are not separated from one another any more than the persons of the Trinity are separate from one another. They are supposed to be harmonious, and they are definitely only distinct. They overlap, and they relate to one another quite a bit. So that's all for today. This has been another very long episode, but there was a lot to talk about. I thought it fitting that in a podcast on intellectual categories and thought that we spent a little extra time on the intellect. And I also thought it was kind of interesting that this was our seventh episode, because seven in the scriptures, as you know, is a perfect and complete number. But we're not yet finished with this series. Next week, we're going to talk about anthropology and the three powers, which I think is a really fascinating topic, talking about the generalization of these primary powers between societies and the way that cultures interact and the way that we understand human being, even in terms of male and female, etc. So I hope you'll tune in next week. I'm really excited about that episode, and I'm excited about this one too. And thank you all again for listening. Until next time.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me. Nothing.